Back together again, wrapping up a week, Friday, December 2nd, 2022 on Connecticut Today. We got word on the program about the arrest of a wanted murder suspect in a grisly case. Yankee Institute reporter Mark Fitch joined us earlier in the show to chat about the ongoing battle between a UConn student and the school's COVID-19 policies. And Landmark Legal Foundation attorney Mike O'Neill talked about the U.S. Supreme Court agreeing to take a look at President Biden's student loan relief plan. That felon who has been on the run since cops say he dismembered after strangling his infant daughter in their home has been apprehended. This story breaking about 35 minutes ago. Liz Hardaway's story here in Hearst, Connecticut media. 31-year-old Christopher Francis Sweeney apprehended near the State Supreme Court building, State Superior Court building. Downtown Waterbury, 400 Grand Street. This happened about 2 hours ago at around 3:05, police saying. Of course, there'll be more details on that, and our friends at News 8 will have an update on this at 6. Cops say they will provide further details on this later on this afternoon and tonight. Francis Sweeney wanted on a warrant charging him with murder with special circumstances and risk of injury to a minor. Authorities say he killed his 11-month daughter in his home on Millville Avenue. He and the child's mother had an argument that morning in Waterbury, where he destroyed his cell phone and he removed a court-ordered monitoring device. That's according to Naugatuck PD. And thank God, maybe out of this brutal tragedy, and we won't get any, look, the guy, there's no death penalty in the state. And yes, in some circumstances, I am still in some rare, distinct, heinous circumstances, I do believe the option should be there for capital punishment. And when it was taken away in this state in the Malloy years, remember Governor Malloy said, you know, but the Cheshire home invasion guys, they're going to be put to death. No, they weren't. And every legal person in the state that I interviewed back then said, no, essentially they said the governor's full of crap. But at that time, something like 60 or 65% of people in the state wanted the option of capital punishment still there for really heinous, abominable crimes. But now, you know, even on the 99.99999% chance this guy gets put away, guess what, kids? He's going to be on your dime and my dime for the next, I don't know, the guy's 31 years old. If they keep him in solitary, away from the general population, let's hope they don't. Little jailhouse justice would be nice here. Oh, Paul, do you think somebody should be killed in prison? Yeah, I am. Got a problem with that? Now let's make sure the legal process plays its way out. You know, everybody deserves legal representation. But this guy's got a rap sheet a mile long. He's a violent felon. So if a little jailhouse justice is brought down on this guy, there's going to be a lot of happy people in this state. And I will lead the crew. Now, having said that, let me just say up front, I lost someone to a violent death in my family who, in my mind, I don't know, should still be in jail. He's not. But that's another story. So I can, when people are shot and killed or stabbed and killed, when it's an ugly criminal act of doing that, I am the last person you want to say to, well, can we get an unemotional take on this? No, for me, you can't. But having said that, you want the process now to play out. But boy, I got to tell you, during this thing, you know, and who knows if this will go to a full trial or if his defense attorneys may tell him, listen, they got you red-handed, just cop a plea and go to jail for the rest of your life. But I'll tell you, this is going to be a kind of thing. Now, look, the death penalty is never coming back in this. It's just not. It's not. And again, I understand people who are morally, who are morally put off by that. I get that. I'm not here to brush your concerns aside. But you wait till this proceeding now picks up in the state, and the details about the strangulation, the alleged strangulation, and the alleged dismemberment and murder of this poor infant, at minimum, we need a, and now apparently there are going to be promises. Oh, we're going to look at why he was out, why he was on the street. This guy had a rap sheet a mile long. He had already done time for assaulting someone. He had assaulted someone else during a carjacking. This guy was not a Boy Scout. But yet he was out on the street, and now we get all these promises. We get all these promises that, you know, we're going to look into why he was on the street. I read that story the other day. There's going to be a thorough investigation of why he was on the street. Well, okay. And is anything going to change? Now, again, every case is individual. I get that. I understand that. But, boy, we got to tighten things up. We have to because a girl is dead. A little one-year-old infant is strangled and dismembered. By all accounts, by a guy who should not have been on the street. Now they're saying, well, and I love these pronouncements. Well, we're going to find out exactly why Mr. Francisquini was on the street. And you know what? They're going to get a lot of folks. I guarantee this. You watch how this unfolds. I guarantee this. You'll get stonewalling. You will get a reluctance from the judicial branch and the corrections branch to reveal what's in their files. They'll cite privacy this and privacy that. I guarantee you, when the hard questions get asked, okay, who said this guy should have this? I guess they gave him some special parole or whatever, and they were going to give him Christmas Day off the parole and Thanksgiving Day. How nice. How nice. So listen, I can only hope that from the governor on down, don't worry, please, governor, if you're listening, I know you do, but from the governor on down, from our state Senate members, our state House members, from all those people on down, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, it shouldn't matter. Whether you're pro-prison reformer, shouldn't matter. Please, I'm telling you and I'm asking you, get to the bottom of this. And if in the end, you come up with an answer like, well, nothing really fell through the cracks here. The process was followed. Procedures were followed. And he was, all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted. We followed the law. We let him out. And unfortunately, this happened. Well, you know what? Then procedures have to be changed. Doesn't mean you'll stop all of these, but very simply, there was one or two things here. It's not hard. Either the proper procedure wasn't followed and bad judgments were made, or the right judgments were made going by the procedure, and there's a little dead one-year-old girl who was strangled and dismembered. If it's the latter and not the former, things have to change. It's not rocket science. It's way above my pay grade, but I can still say stuff, you know, that blank needs to get tightened up. Our monthly check-in with our buddy, our pal Mark Fitch from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Mark writes pieces for them and for the Institute's Inside Investigator site. Go to insideinvestigator.org. And Mark, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well, Paul. It's good to be on with you.
Well, thanks for coming on, Mark. We appreciate you checking in with us. You have a new piece there. This is a fascinating story. Her Choice, One Exceptional Student's Stand Against UConn's COVID Policy. Who is this student? And she's only 16 years old. Talk about this story, Mark.
Sure. The student is Phoebe Liu, and she was age 16 when she was admitted to UConn in 2020. And, you know, she had been homeschooled and, you know, had already taken college courses. You know, we're talking about a very high-performing student. And she was admitted to UConn with $50,000 in scholarships. On a pre-dental track, she wanted to go into UConn's, you know, highly, you know, specialized, you know, dental program. And what happened, though, was as, you know, she got in, obviously, it was, you know, for the spring semester of 2020, COVID hit, you know, we all know what kind of happened there. And, you know, people went to online classes and all this kind of stuff. And she was going along just fine. She was merit scholar and a Babbage scholar. And, you know, she was top of her class, all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But when the vaccine came out, she was hesitant. I guess we called them like vaccine hesitant people. And just because of the speed at which it was developed, and she didn't know enough about it. And so she opted out of getting the vaccine.
And we should, point out here, and I know you'll get into this, this was not a political thing with her, some free speech with her. She and her family and her thinking was all grounded in her interpretation of science, correct?
Yeah, I would say that. I just in conversations, I think once the mandates started coming down, I think it became a little bit more motivated by other factors, you know, because it's like, one of the things with the vaccines is that, you know, once you start mandating something, mm-hmm. then people get really suspicious, you know? I'd say she was just, you know what? This is brand new. I'm not in the risk group, and I'm going to, you know, UConn allowed people to opt out. Only about 800 kids out of 34,000 did, but she was one of them. And, you know, so she got her non-medical exemption, and in the exemption it said surveillance testing recommended. And she said, fine, you know, you can recommend anything, really. I mean, you recommend, you know, drinking 8 glasses of water a day, and we don't do it. But, you know, so she's like, fine. And she went back to doing her classes. Well, come fall of 2021, she starts getting emails saying that she is not going to be allowed to register for her next semester's classes and will lose her scholarships if she doesn't go take a test, a COVID test. And they were saying that she is mandatorily required to take weekly COVID tests. And so when she went to go take the test, there was some language on the testing kit that she found very suspicious. Basically, you know, it said it was a DNA collection kit. It was part of a DNA collection kit that was authorized for emergency use mm-hmm. to, you know, send COVID samples or, you know, spit samples to be tested. But she wasn't comfortable with it. She wasn't comfortable with the nasal swabs because they're treated with a particular kind of chemical that can be cancerous, especially, you know, she's like, if you want me to do this every week, you know, that seems a little, you know, like I'm really kind of subjecting myself to this.
Yeah.
She took a principled stand saying, you know, these are only authorized, you know, emergency authorized products. I don't feel comfortable with them. I'm not going to take them. And she ended up losing her scholarships and not being allowed to re-enroll for classes in spring of 2022.
Our monthly check-in with our buddy, our pal Mark Fitch, who was an investigative reporter and author for the Yankee Institute. Check it out, yankeeinstitute.org. And you can check out the Inside Investigator website from the Institute, insideinvestigator.org. His feature story up there now, Her Choice, One Exceptional Student Stand Against UConn's COVID Policy. So Phoebe Liu, has pushed back on this COVID testing. She's not really enthused about this. UConn says you got to do this to start taking classes again. So pick up the story from there.
Sure. So, I mean, she obviously wasn't able to register for 2022. And, you know, what's kind of interesting is, you know, a lot of, you know, most of Connecticut's colleges and universities had these kind of mandates in place. But by April of 2022, the state college and university system, so all the community colleges, all the state colleges, they all lifted those mandates. And they said, all right, we don't have to do this weekly testing anymore. We're kind of going back to normal here. And UConn held out much longer. I mean, UConn lifted the mandate. This is where you start getting into, you know, some of the weird things mm-hmm. that, you know, during the COVID pandemic. You know, they lifted the mandate, the vaccine and testing mandate for their staff and their employees and their professors and things like that. So people in the higher risk demographic, they lifted the mandates for them, kept them for the students. And that's, you know, and I think that's kind of a strong point there. It's like, okay, what are we doing here? And that's the point that she's raised repeatedly, is you're lifting it for the people who are more at risk. And UConn had a very high vaccine uptake. It was like 99%, which, of course, I mean, you're mandating it, so you're going to have very high uptake. Sure. And part of her point is me walking around, you know, not vaccinated among 99% of the people who are, is not going to change anything. Mm. And why am I being discriminated against for my choices?
So what was the school's pushback against that, Mark?
Well, there was no real pushback. They just didn't allow her to register for class.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
They it was easy enough for them, I guess, but it was pretty hard on her and anybody else who might have been affected by it. But, you know, UConn has now changed their policy. So, you know, I don't know if Phoebe is planning to go back, but you could have caught her today at Yale because she was down there doing a protest, speaking at a protest over Yale's booster requirements mm-hmm. for students there. So she's become kind of this mild-mannered activist. You know, she's very soft-spoken, very intelligent. But she, you know, her story has caught the ear of other groups that are opposed to these kind of mandates, and she is working with them and, you know, telling her story.
And Mark Fitch, you write in the piece, I guess I read, that she's, you know, undecided about going back to UConn, pursuing her goal of getting a dental certification, a degree from UConn. Did I see in your piece where she's an amazing young woman here? She's also started a marketing company right now just to, like, fill in the gaps. As she's doing that with photography and brand marketing and all this. Did I see that?
Oh, yeah. I tell you, Paul, it's so easy to hate these overachievers sometimes.
Right?
makes me feel so unaccomplished, and I'm like 43 years old. Yeah. She, in the meantime, she decided that she really had a love for, you know, graphic design and photography. So she started her own little photography business, and she's doing graphic design for several companies across the country. Just a little thing that she picked up, you know, during her studies at UConn. So, but, you know, Phoebe does really want to go back to UConn for the pre-dental track. She says she misses her, you know, advisors and mentors there, and, you know, is absolutely, you know, dead set on going back. So, you know, when she finds the time, you know, between running this little marketing company or, you know, graphic design company that she's doing.
Yeah, she probably gets up at like 5 in the morning and goes to bed at like, you know, midnight and only subsists on 5 hours sleep. And, you know.
I know. It was a tough interview because she's telling me all these things that she accomplished. I'm like, oh, I got out of bed this morning. You know, I think I did all right, you know.
Made coffee without burning myself, you know, stuff like that. Folks, check it out. It's a much more detailed story, but we wanted to give you a little flavor of it. Her choice, one exceptional student stand against UConn's COVID policy. We're talking about Phoebe Liu, who got into UConn with scholarships at just 16, but she was disturbed by some of UConn's COVID policies. InsideInvestigator.org. Mark Fitch is the guest. Mark, thanks. Have a good weekend. As always, great to hear from you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul.
All right. Take care. Thank you, Mark. All right. So there you go. Her choice, one exceptional student stand against UConn's COVID policy. And again, the reason I recommend this is, and as Mark said, it's not, listen, yeah, UConn may have, you know, held on a little longer here with their COVID policy and testing and all this. But that's part of the story. The other part of the story is you read this and you say, wow, good for her. Even if you don't agree with her stand, it's amazing that somebody who's like 16 going on 17 is as intellectually based as she was or is to put a cogent argument together, whether you agree with it or not, to, you know, voice concern over some things that a lot of people were concerned about. Surprise to some, no surprise to some, the U.S. Supreme Court said a couple of days ago they will get involved in this controversy as to whether or not President Biden can unilaterally go ahead and forgive either $10,000 or $20,000 of student loan debt. Now, it's been tied up in the lower courts, and one of our go-to guys on all things legal, Mike O'Neill from the Landmark Legal Foundation, joins us to chat about this. Mike, hi, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Paul. Good afternoon.
Well, thanks for joining us. Appreciate this. You surprised? You surprised that the SCOTUS is stepping in on this or not, Mike?
No. Well, they were always going to step in on it. It was just a matter of when they were going to step in on this. And this is procedurally. This is as you noted. This is faster than it normally would have been. Traditionally, Supreme Court cases gesticulate up to the Supreme Court through the appellate on the merits basis and up through the appellate process. These are procedural motions. The court here is ruling on an injunction, which is a temporary preliminary injunction, which is a temporary stoppage of the implementation of the plan before the merits can actually be heard of it. So this is an accelerated. These are all accelerated motions that are done before the actual merits of the cases are heard. But the court, once you had appellate courts enjoining or stopping implementation of this, you knew that it was going to get up to the Supreme Court on a fast track. And they are hearing it in February. So, yes, it is accelerated. And it was just a matter of time. So this is probably a good thing. It's going to resolve the issue for all intents and purposes here. And it's going to hopefully the court's going to definitively rule whether, number one, these litigants, the states here in this case, have standing, and number two, the merits of it, whether the Department of Education and President Biden have the authority, as you just said, have the authority to implement this kind of plan.
And Mike, as you've told us earlier on this, I guess the dueling points of view here, the people who don't like this say, listen, you can do this, but it's got to go through Congress because all federal money is controlled by the House. And the other people say, hey, wait a minute, the president can do this because of a law, Mike, that was passed post 9/11.
Right, the HEROES Act. And this is a law that says, and when you're talking about the merits of this, that's exactly what you're going to get into. This is a matter, again, of statutory interpretation and of the authority. What we've always talked about lots of times is the authority of an administrative agency or the president to do something under a law. Now, does this law, the HEROES Act, which you just talked about, apply to this? Are you able to extrapolate from the language of the law, the statute here, authority to forgive tens of thousands of dollars in student loans and have $400 billion. I think the estimate is affect the economy of $400 billion. You're talking about here, right? So essentially, this is a major issue, a major question. And again, let's talk about what we've talked about in the past. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, last term we had that major questions doctrine come down the pike. In that case, West Virginia versus EPA, and the Supreme Court, Ketanji Brown Jackson versus Justice Breyer. So there is a one justice difference, but essentially the same six justices there who ruled in Massachusetts versus EPA said an administrative agency like the Department of Education cannot engage in an action that would have vast and significant political and economic consequences unless there's an express grant of authority from Congress to act. So the major questions doctrine is going to be front and center again before the Supreme Court, and we're going to see whether the administration and the really smart Solicitor General can kind of shoehorn the authority into this. They rely on the federal government relies on the term emergency. They say that the COVID emergency, that the statute clearly allows the Department of Education to modify these loans, forgive these loans, suspend payment of these loans in cases of national emergency. Well, in March of 2020, that's what President Trump did. He said, well, I'm going to suspend payments on this. I'm not going to obligate individuals who hold these loans to make these payments because there is a national emergency. Well, in March of 2020, it was probably fair to say there was a national emergency. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? We're not in 2020 anymore. And now, is there a national emergency? I don't think so. We'll see what the court says.
All right, Mike O'Neill, for a few more minutes from the Landmark Legal Foundation. Just to be upfront, Landmark is a conservative-leaning foundation. A lot of you folks know that, but the analysis is good anyway. 203-333-9422. Back to open phones. Coming up, we're talking to Mike about the Supreme Court taking up arguments in February as to whether or not there is authority from President Biden under a law passed post 9/11 to chop either 10 or 20 grand off of the student loan debt that would total about $400 million. Mike, is there any way to, and you kind of previewed it, any way sure. to kind of predict what the argument is going to be in specifics with that
right.
post 9/11 law? You mentioned, of course, this does fall on the Solicitor General. Forgive me, who is he or she, and how do you think they'll attack the case?
Oh, Elizabeth Prelogar, who's a fantastic, she's obviously for the Biden administration, so philosophically we probably differ, but she is by any stretch, a fantastic litigator and a fantastic appellate advocate, probably one of the leading lights for the left legal establishment, the liberal legal establishment versus the conservative legal establishment. So she's exceptionally qualified, and you saw even throughout all of those tough oral arguments of last term, we're talking the Dobbs case, the West Virginia versus EPA, time and time again, she was exceptional. And so they're going to put their best foot forward. Really, there's two issues here. What they're really going to try to get it hung up on, the Biden administration and the Department of Justice is going to try to get it hung up on, is this issue of standing here. Now, standing, they're going to assert, and they've always asserted this throughout at every level, is that these states have not suffered any harm. And because the states don't have an important issue in litigation is you have to have suffered some
sure.
sort of cognizable harm in order to have what is known as standing. Now, their case, their argument will be, well, these states haven't suffered any harm. One of the states that's brought this suit is Missouri. It has a nonprofit, kind of a state-run, state-underwritten nonprofit that services loans.
Mm-hmm.
And by that connection, it tries to say, well, by these loans being forgiven, this nonprofit is not going to have revenue, and then that revenue won't therefore flow into the state of Missouri's coffers. Therefore, Missouri is going to have some problems. Is going to suffer a cognizable injury. It's kind
yeah.
of diffused there. So they're going to argue standing first and foremost, and then second, they're going to argue, of course, statutory authority, that this HERO Act is applicable, that the Department of Education has had authority, broad-based authority, widely understood that broad-based authority to manage the student loan system in our country, and that this just falls squarely within that authority. So they're going to make their best arguments. Again, here we go. I know
yeah.
I sound like a broken record with but guardedly optimistic. We've got, we saw last year with West Virginia versus EPA that the Supreme Court had no problem striking down the Clean Power Plan. And again, and interestingly enough, in that case, there was another argument about standing, about whether the issue was ripe, a little procedural issue that the court kind of was able to dispense with and get right to the issue. So I think we might see something very similar to that. Real timing, you did mention that it's going to be, oral arguments are going to be in February. This might be a little faster. We might not see I traditionally say we see these decisions in June, May and June. This might be a little faster because there's some immediacy to the issue. You have a lot of people out there trying to understand what's going to go on with their loans. So you might see it before summer or late spring.
Yeah. Finally, Mike O'Neill, knowing that all this is going to happen, listen, the justices are not neophytes. I mean, you don't get to that level not knowing what the arguments are going to be. Major League Baseball players know this guy's got a good fastball, this guy's got a good changeup. Nobody is surprised anymore. So they know what the arguments will be.
Mm-hmm.
So judging by what you may know about what some of these justices think, any thoughts of who may be sympathetic to this, Mike? Who might be like, nah, get out of here with that? Any justices you think that might be swayed actually by the arguments? Any thoughts on that?
Well, it depends from what perspective. If you're talking about the perspective of the challengers to the program, the authority, again, you're going to see your traditional conservative justices, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, even Roberts, again, they look very skeptically on a vast power conferred to administrative agencies like the Department of Education. They want to see, look, this is a $400 billion effect on the economy. Everybody agrees on that. Congress should speak. The people should speak definitively on this. And so if this is such an important issue, and again, think about the politics here involved. Yeah. You're talking about a wealth transfer from students, a lot of people who have, you know, advanced degrees, to working class people who are paying the taxes here. So there's all kinds of political. And then there's the issue of Biden, you know, fulfilling a campaign promise that he said he was going to forgive his loans and bypassing Congress. So I do think that, you know, here we go. I think that there's a high degree of chance that Biden takes a loss here. And the Supreme Court says, hey, you know, this might not be pretty, but you have to go to Congress. And Congress has to speak on this.
All right. Great stuff. Mike O'Neill, Landmark Legal Foundation. Mike, let's get our beverages and snacks, and we'll watch this, and we'll check in with you down
Absolutely.
The road. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Take care, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right. There you go. All right. A little... Say one of our legal eagles nationally. We have local lawyers and constitutional experts, too. So there you go. So if you have anywhere in Fairfield or New Haven County, if you have, you know, student loans for your son or your daughter or grandson or granddaughter, we'll probably know shortly after February whether or not, like Mike said, the Supreme Court will allow this relief or the depending upon, of course, what loans do you have and if you... If you fit in the income categories, this relief of either $10,000 or $20,000, depending upon what the High Court says, thanks to Mike O'Neill.